Welcome to the Health Design Podcast. Here's your host, Moyez Jiwa.
When Sarah Parker Ward and I started our conversation, I thought we were going to be talking about death. And in the end, we started talking about how that conversation leads to a much more enlightened view of life itself. Here to share her perspective is Sarah Parker Ward. Sarah, you're very welcome to this call. I'm delighted to meet you on the Health Design Podcast.
I am so happy to be joining you, Moyez. We have so much to cover, and the urgency of covering it is certainly clear to both of us. So thank you for welcoming me.
So let's dive in. I know that your particular area of interest is in death and dying and something called death cognition. I didn't understand the term death cognition. Can you elaborate a little bit on that to kick off with?
When we're talking about death cognition, we're talking about the idea of how people literally think about death. And what we find is that there are two major trajectories in the theoretical space that have a lot of scholarship. One is terror management theory, and that's really where I focused a lot of my early scholarship. And terror management theory has built up four, almost five decades worth of experimental scholarship at this point that shows us that when we just drop the idea of mortality into someone's lap, there are a lot of consequences to that. Over the last 150 years, we've really industrialized death. We've outsourced it from the family space. And in doing so, we've really cultivated this very deep-seated psychological fear around our mortality. I am really interested in understanding how people think about death. And consequently, I'm also looking at the contemplation of death. And what we find almost antithetical to terror management theory is self-determination theory. And this is when we provide people a safe space in which to think about death, to contemplate the natural cycle that we are part of, we actually find the opposite of these sort of scared reflexes. We find this opportunity for people to feel wholesome in that space. We find that they become less materialistic. They become more pro-social. And as I was sharing earlier, people become very clear about their goals. They become very excited to think about leveraging their time on this earth in a way that is meaningful, than more than just building wealth, but really in building legacy and in supporting the people that they love.
We have industrialized it, not just in society, but also still in the hospital sector. So the mortuary is somewhere you don't really want to go anywhere near. It's far away, usually in the bowels of the hospital. It's where mistakes, quote unquote, are sent. It's where failures are sent. And the idea that as soon as the patient has died, the curtains are drawn as quickly as possible, the body bags appear and the gurney appears and the person is taken away and there's a silence and people don't want to talk about it. It's an eerie feeling. And that's the experience in healthcare. From your perspective, where does all this come from?
You know, it's very clear if we look at the political arc. And so a little bit more about my background, Moyez, is the way that I came to this after a decade in digital communications and marketing, I had had two children via home birth. And so I became very interested in understanding how pregnant people made decisions about where they wanted to birth, how they wanted to birth. And again, the element of self-determination playing a role in healthcare. When I went back for my PhD and returned to academia, that's when I discovered that in the US at least, and in many Western nations, the same arc, political arc, industrializational arc that we find in birth, we find in death. So around 1880s, post-Civil War, we had new technologies like embalming, and we saw this interest in moving death out of the home, in medicalizing it, in losing the social customs, the community customs, the sense of ritual that were so prescient. At the turn of the century, we had fewer than 1,000 funeral homes. By 1920, we had 25,000 funeral homes across the country. And so you just see this rapid movement. And then at the same time, we're moving towards the need for two-income families throughout the 40s and 50s. And so this idea of people being able to take off time, both before and after a death, not just the people directly responsible for caregiving, because certainly we still have informal unpaid caregivers by the millions across the country, but the bigger, wider kinship network, taking time off to be there, was no longer economically feasible. And so there was this just incredible confluence of events that really moved us away from the intimacy and the sacredness of death and ritual. And it really built up this taboo over that 100 years. And then in the 70s, and increasingly so until now, we're seeing younger generations usurp a lot of those values around silent suffering, individualized approaches, and really want to reclaim and revitalize that space.
The consequence of that for society is of bad grief. In other words, grief that leads to mental illness and other distress because people have not processed exactly what has happened. Just because it wasn't your wife, your husband, somebody close to you that you lost doesn't mean that you don't experience the loss for whatever reason.
One of the most liberating experiences that I had as an adult was to learn just how varied grief is and to learn that it's not linear, that you can experience it even when it's someone you didn't know intimately who has died. We can even grieve parts of our lives that have passed. And so learning how to cope effectively and teaching our children to do this is so vital. A very recent example, my daughter confided in me a conversation that had happened at school. She was talking about a mutual friend. This friend said, "I don't understand. I know that," and we'll say it's Jessica. "I know that Jessica lost her sister 2 years ago, and she just jokes about it. And I don't understand how she could just joke about it. It's so strange. Isn't that kind of sick?" And my daughter, being raised in a very death-positive household, said to this friend, "Maybe that's the only way they know how to cope. Maybe they're just doing their best." It was such a proud mom moment, but such a beautiful example of what can happen, because her friend then replied to her after a long pause, "You know what? Maybe you're right." And I think we need to have more of that open dialogue across the board, but especially in our healthcare institutions to help lead the way. And I'm very ingrained in the death doula movement, in the green burial movement, and I think we have this beautiful nexus happening where there are alternative healthcare providers, non-clinical care providers, working and increasingly starting to work in institutional spaces, or at least collaborate with institutional spaces to provide whole person care and care that extends beyond the time of death. Being able to go and work with a shroud crafter or to go to a willow weaver and bring your children and weave your loved one's casket, or to even engage some of the healthcare providers in that, is a beautiful transcendent experience that completely shifts the dialogue around dying and certainly shifts survivorhood.
Is there evidence that when this is done in a more natural way, in a way that was done in the 1600s, 1700s, and even before that, that somehow it is a much more positive experience for all concerned?
There is a large body of scholarship stemming both from near-death experiences starting in the 1960s, as well as contemplative care as it relates to death contemplation specifically, that shows that, again, we find people become more pro-social. They engage in these conversations earlier on. They reduce their sense of materialism. And so all of those things are certainly beautiful outcomes. When it comes to death doulas in particular and their role, we're seeing scholarship flourish. I actually just did a Scopus search 2 days ago on this. And since 2013, we've consistently seen more scholarship increase. Interestingly enough, a vast majority of that is coming out of Australia and not the US, but we are seeing it rise. It's this really interesting opportunity for us to engage these conversations in an embodied way as well to derive those stronger outcomes. Similarly, we're able to approach advanced care planning with people. And I know that there is some mixed scholarship around the effectiveness of advanced care planning. Part of that is related to the modality and accessibility in emergent care situations. Part of it is related to equity. We know that there are serious equity and racial disparities when it comes to advanced care planning in the US. But by and large, when we're able to at least have those conversations, we're able to stimulate people thinking about how do we share our wishes with the people who ultimately will be in charge of making those decisions.
The Health Design Podcast is hosted by the Journal of Health Design, in alliance with Unfixed Media and Metal Health.
I want to focus a little bit on something that you've said a couple of times now, which intrigues me, and that was that there's a reduced sense of materialism. And you've said this a couple of times in relation to how we respond when we are more positive about the concept of death and dying. Because this is something that you hear a lot in the Stoic literature and in a lot of the more contemporary approaches to how we should live.
I think that there are two elements here. One is when we think about death and we think about the natural cycles, we realize that we're not disparate from nature. We are nature. And so there's this relationship that blossoms and flourishes in the sense of, well, I want to care for me being part of nature. We also see, though, people become very clear on their priorities and what truly matters to them. I guarantee that if I went out and I surveyed 1,000 people tomorrow and I said, if you had 24 hours left to live, would you spend it retail shopping or would you spend it with the people that you love? 100% of those people would say they want to spend it with the people that they love. They would want to tell the people, use that time to have a lasting impact, to make amends with family and friends that perhaps they have rifts with. It really becomes about having, again, that sacred sense. And we see this often at end of life, at a natural end of life, where people become very focused on family, on friends, on pro-social attitudes, on creating those rituals that create connection, and far less so on capitalist endeavors or spending money or retail therapy, things of that nature.
You're talking, Sarah, about healing in the widest possible sense. You're talking about healing that is physical, social, psychological, spiritual. So if we were to approach this from the healthcare perspective, and we're talking about the delivery of healthcare, what are the first steps we need to take along the path towards a much more holistic view of our patients?
Oh, this is such a good question. I really think the first piece is the lexicon that we're using. Engaging people in end-of-life communication in a way that is extremely open, that is normalized, that asks them, what does a good ending look like for you? And how can I support that? And going beyond just the medical components, it's not just a DNR, it's not just a pulse. It's having whole person conversations around the spiritual components. It's not just the medical model, it's the bio, psycho, social, spiritual model. And engaging people in that at a younger and younger age. I think those conversations really should be had when someone's 30. We know that in their 20s, cognitively, there's still that Superman mentality, that, and we can't work through that, and that's okay. But in the 30s, we start to see a shift. especially when parenthood comes into play, because people are more willing to engage conversations, whether it's life insurance or last will and testament, things of that nature, to ensure that their child is protected should they die. And so really, it's about having these conversations at a much earlier point in the life course, both to stimulate, again, a better life itself, but then to make sure that there is clarity on what a good end looks like, because just like taxes, it's the only other thing that's guaranteed.
When we look at how advanced care planning is being rolled out, it's being rolled out in people in their late 50s, early 60s. No one is saying to the 30-year-old that comes in and says, I haven't had some blood tests for a while, I should come and have some blood tests. No one says, have you thought about how you'd like to die? But it is a conversation that needs to be had, as you say, because once the seeds are set, once you're not telling them they're going to die tomorrow morning, once you start to unpack that conversation, you start to talk about things that you've mentioned in the conversation. In other words, how do you want to live? It's not about how do you want to die. It's almost flipping it on its side and saying, what I'm actually asking you is this. But a good way to talk about it is, how would you like to end your life?
One of the greatest opportunities that we have right now with the sandwich generation, with millennials who are balancing both children and caring for parents who are aging, is that conversation. It's this opportunity to apply the conversation that they're having about their parents to them as well, and to inspire in the next generation. I am trained in death doula work. I was trained through Anelda, and again, have a wide network of doulas. And I can't tell you how many people have come to me asking for questions and guidance about how to engage their children in better end-of-life conversations, because they know that this is on the horizon for their parents. And I think that that is such a beautiful shift that we are seeing, that more people are open to normalizing these conversations for their children. To me, it's essential. One of the greatest gifts we can give our children is the understanding, in a safe context, that eventually we are part of nature, we will pass, and that they will be fine because we have helped them every step of the way to understand that that is a part of nature and that that is a healthy part of nature. And when we do that, we're shifting the fighter mentality that we see as such a dominant language in healthcare, so that the person fought until the very end, that they lost the battle with cancer. And we're turning it on its head, and we're saying that person had a good life and we're proud of what they did until the end, not that they lost.
The challenge for us in healthcare is this immortality complex that has appeared since the genome was discovered and since we started to believe it is possible to turn off the things that eventually lead to death. That is not the experience for a lot of people, the majority of people. You just cannot currently turn off the genome. But there is a narrative that unless you advocate for yourself really very hard, you won't get the thing that's offering you immortality. And this is the challenge, isn't it? It's between that and the idea of a good death.
When I think about the biggest challenge that we have right now, it's both the scale and the urgency of shifting this dialogue, because so many people are focused on shifting it for just our aging population. The folks who will be dying in the next 20 years are 10,000 baby boomers who are turning 65 on a daily basis in this country. But at the same time, I go back to those millennials and even the younger generation in helping them really solidify this new approach to end of life, to overcoming that complex towards immortality and really appreciating it as part of the natural cycle. And I think green burial has a really interesting role in that. Again, a way of extending our understanding of being part of nature, of being transient. And so that's been a new avenue, opening up a lot of really interesting conversations for people.
The Journal of Health Design, fostering collaboration amplifying the voice of health advocates, growing a network to improve outcomes in healthcare.
Talk a little bit about green burial. What does that look like from your perspective?
A traditional green burial is one that is typically family-centered. That doesn't mean that it's not happening in a funeral home. It can happen in a funeral home, or it can be a home funeral for certain. It can be anything from a traditional funeral to a celebration of life. But what's happening, the real distinction here, is that the individual is not being embalmed with traditional embalming fluids, which we know are harmful for the environment. They are not being put in a casket that is made of metal and that is going to go into the ground and then be impenetrable for the foreseeable decades or millennia. Instead, they are being put into a casket typically that is made of willow, that is made of locally sourced wood, and being put in the ground at a level that will allow for the soil to actually fully decompose both the casket or the container, the shroud that the body is wrapped in, and the body itself, usually within a year, less than a year. There are very strict regulations about green burial that certainly across the U.S., any cemetery that is involved in still has to follow, just like a traditional cemetery. It's a great opportunity for people to really think about their carbon footprint, their eco impact beyond the grave, so to speak. We're finding that it's this great opportunity to engage people in end-of-life planning and end-of-life conversations because this is such a motivator for so many people. Individuals who have spent their lives dedicated to environmental practices, to the green movement, they want that to continue on. And so we're really just starting to see this open up and for there to be widespread adoption and even, I dare say, excitement about this solution. We do have some other options as well. Now in the U.S., we have natural organic reduction, which is essentially human composting is sort of the layman's term for that, which is where bodies are put in containers. They're essentially decomposed more rapidly through natural processes. And then families are given that compost back to use in their gardens. And we also have alkaline hydrolysis, which is a complement to traditional fire cremation, and similarly has a much reduced carbon footprint over traditional burial as well as fire cremation. And so all of these are opportunities ever shifting in the political landscape, but opportunities for us to engage with people who are motivated particularly in the environmental practice of their death.
How do we decouple the conversation around death from politics? Because when you hear the word green and you have visions of left-wing thinking and all the rest of it, but we want it to be an inclusive experience for people to understand that death is a normal experience for all of us and will, as you say, be inevitable. How do we decouple those two conversations? Because they seem to be quite closely linked at the moment.
It is so true. I think back to my dissertation while I was finishing up my doctorate, and the line that I wrote that will stick with me forever is that dying is one of the most political acts we will all engage in, because they are so tightly interwoven. That being said, I think, again, when we're able to create these safe spaces, whether it's death cafes, death over drafts, we now have the death deck, lots of different opportunities to engage in non-politicized conversations. When we're able to open the doorways to those in a community setting, I think we find really fruitful outcomes. We even have now in the US silent death reading sessions. So everyone congregates on Zoom, they pick out a death-related text, and everyone reads silently together. We have a real flourishing happening of community-driven, grassroots-driven discussions about this, that at the end of the day, when it's you and someone else chatting over a draft, it's a very different conversation than when you're reading something on a news media outlet or that has been mediated in some other way through a political context.
The concept of death as something that takes us away from consumerism, from consumption, from using the earth as opposed to contributing to the earth and living with the earth in a more positive way. and being more creative. That is a concept that is extremely appealing for a number of reasons. Primarily because it increases our productivity, it makes us more likely to succeed in life. And yet, politically, it seems counterintuitive to many people. You've talked a little bit about some of the movements. At a personal level, how do we do this? How do we, regardless of what's going on around us, espouse the thoughts that you are sharing with us today?
Well, that's my favorite question, Moya, is how do we do it on the individual level? Absolutely. The thing that I encourage any individual to do, regardless of field, religion, spiritual beliefs, is just to go out and be in a natural environment and just look around at the cycles that are happening near you. Try and sync with that. Here in upstate New York, we're experiencing autumn right now. The leaves are dying, and yet there's a beauty to that. There's an absolute beauty. I mean, literally, as you know, as they're dying, they're turning these incredible shades of red and yellow. It is this transcendent experience. So to just be with that, to see how it feels, to look at it through the lens of the natural cycle of life and death, and just sit with the sensations that arise. Give yourself that grace to think about, does this make me uncomfortable? Why is it making me uncomfortable? Where am I feeling that dis-ease? Is it something that I'm thinking about? Is it something, a physical sensation? Is it an emotional reaction? And to make that a bit of a practice, don't just do it once, do it more than once, return to it, and then start to look if it's something that you feel comfortable continuing to explore on the individual level, continue to do that. There are so many resources out there, films, books, podcasts available to help people explore this in a safe way. If, on the other hand, it's bringing up too many negative sensations for a person, consider connecting with your spiritual leader about this. If you have that, a chaplain, if you're within an institution. Similarly, there are death doulas across the US. We see them in Italy. We see them in Australia. Death doulas are wonderfully resourced individuals, non-secular in their approach. They're able to provide psychosocial and spiritual support. And often they have a number of creative outlets for doing so. And so I think moving in either of those directions, but just starting in the natural environment, because we know that just being in a natural environment tends to calm the nervous system, tends to clear the space. I should add, if you can leave your phone at home, if you can turn on the do not disturb during that, kudos to you. But that seems to be an approachable way for a lot of people.
Sarah Parker Ward, it's been a joy spending time with you. You've given us something today. You've given us something to help us to start the journey towards a much more positive experience, not just with the concept of death and dying, but with life itself, which is a fantastic gift. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having me. I hope that you, Moyes, are able to take away some spiritual direction out of this to live a more fruitful life. But I hope that someone out there listening who maybe has been struggling with this has a new way to approach it and feels a little bit less alone in doing so, because it's not strange to feel that way. But there is a growing movement of people who are ready to provide support.
The Health Design Podcast, serving patient and physician advocates. Visit us at journalofhealthdesign.com.